Members of the Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Rowley.
Rowley present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Long. That concludes roll call.
Very well, member. We do have a quorum. Just to share with the public, this hearing is being held conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations, in response to the COVID-19 infectious disease pandemic requiring public health exercise of social distancing. Members, we have three items on the agenda today. You'll see two, but there are actually three. Regular items are a presentation on the task force for missing and murdered Indigenous women, and then followed by deliberation and action on House File 321, Representative Feist. There is a third part that comes out of a conversation I had yesterday with a minority lead, Representative Johnson. I was going to leave that to the end of the meeting, Representative Johnson, but I do see your hand up, and I suspect maybe it's up for that purpose, and so I would certainly entertain your ability to share a few minutes of some thoughts that you have regarding some of the police accountability issues, discussions that we had last week. We will be having extended conversations later this week on those issues in particular, particularly as they manifest themselves and are part of our realities in law enforcement in greater Minnesota. But Representative Johnson, I leave it to you. We can wait to the end, or we can certainly hear from you at this point.
I would prefer to do this now to get this over with.
Very well, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, last Thursday was probably one of the worst public safety committee hearings I've heard and been involved in my entire five terms down at the state legislature here. The inflammatory statements and false statements made by some of the testifiers were just outrageous. Our members of our law enforcement community are probably the most highly trained and highly continuous education in the entire country. In fact, we have multiple states coming to Minnesota to recruit law enforcement officers from our trained personnel that we have in our VOTECs and our colleges, as we probably do the best job across the country in training of officers. The inflammatory statements were uncalled for, but I will have to say this. Do we have a rare occasion where it happens? Possibly. We're part of the human race. But the vast majority of our law enforcement officers across the state are not what they were being called. It was so inflammatory, I refuse to use that term. I'm disappointed. And what's even more disappointing is the fact that the minority was never offered an opportunity to question or rebut any of these statements that were made. I'm going to ask the chair that any statements like that I've made again, that they offer the minority an opportunity to respond and to ask questions of the bigoted statements that were made. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We did have a conversation about this, you and I, yesterday. I do appreciate you reaching out to speak with me. As I shared at that time, I don't agree with your perception of our hearing, and I hope that we can agree to disagree. I think what is critically, objectively important is that to the extent that time allows, that all voices in the committee would be offered an opportunity to be heard. In that regard, I will certainly ask on all committee members to be part of making sure that that happens. If one person is dominating the conversation, it means there's less time for your colleagues to also participate. I will try to move this expeditiously through those conversations, but it is typically not unusual that every single voice will always be heard in every hearing, just because of the pragmatic nature of concluding our business or committee hearing by a certain time. As I mentioned, we will be continuing to hear issues around police accountability. We're going to have a couple more hearings just this week, and there's still a long session in front of us, and so I hope that that will certainly offer opportunities for everyone to be able to weigh in, and including members from the public as well. So with members, with that, Representative O'Neill, I see your hand is up, but if it's to this matter, what I want to do is move the agenda for today. We have testifiers here on two important subjects. I will certainly put you on the list if there's time at the end for you and anyone else to return to this topic for the day. And as I indicated, we will be continuing this conversation around police accountability in the state of Minnesota pretty much through most of the session. So with that, members, the first part of today's presentation, or the first part of today's, I guess it's the second part of today's hearing, is a presentation from the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. For those of you who are on the committee last year, this was last session, this was a major piece of legislation that we passed in 2019 that in the end became, I believe, a strong bipartisan effort, with the Senate also passing a standalone bill that we then did as well. The Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force was created to examine the root causes, systemic problems, and potential solutions of violence against Indigenous women and girls in Minnesota, including the task force included members from the legislature, from the 11 tribal nations and community advocacy organizations, from law enforcement and the legal field. Wilder Research assisted that task force in conducting extensive research. Their report was finalized last year. In fact, last year we did a small extension to make sure that they had sufficient funding to finish their report. And again, that was a good, strong bipartisan effort, and much appreciation to all our colleagues. There are 20 recommendations or mandates and recommendations in five key areas from the task force. And so the purpose today is to recenter ourselves in this important work, to hear directly from people involved in the task force, and to hear what those recommendations are. No doubt we will later in this session return to some of those recommendations in the form of legislation. I do want to do a shout out to our former House colleague, who is now a senator, Mary Kunish Padin, who was the chief author of the bill here in the House. She's present with us today. I suspect she'll be part of the presentation. So and welcome you back to the place where you really do belong, Senator Kunesh Padin, in the House. With that, I believe the order will be to hear from Nicole Matthews, Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, and then Senator Kunesh, and then also Nicole Martin Rogers, Senior Research Manager of Wilder Research. I believe we're starting with you, though, however, Ms. Matthews. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Mani Dubane Shikwain, Dijnakaz Migazin Dodem. I am Nicole Matthews. I'm Anishinaabe from the Wyeth Band of Ojibwe and Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition. I believe actually Senator Kunesh is going to get us started, but we thought we'd do a quick introduction and then she'll kick it off.
Wonderful. Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, everybody, and it feels really good to be back here and to see all of your faces again and all the new legislators that are over there. So thank you for giving us this opportunity to share the findings of this task force. And I'll just take a second and ask Nicole Martin Rogers to introduce herself.
Ms. Martin Rogers, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Nicole Martin Rogers. I'm a senior research manager at Wilder Research, and I'm a descendant of White Earth Nation. Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
Great. Honestly, this task force and the number of people that worked on it are to be commended for the hard work that they have done. For those of you who are not familiar with this task force, I introduced this legislation to create the task force back in 2018, I think, was our first time. And it was the first time for most legislators to hear about the historic trauma and tragedy that has plagued our Indigenous, our American Indian communities, not just here in Minnesota, but across the country and actually across the globe. And so we put together this task force and shared it with all of our legislators and received full bipartisan support, both in the House and in the Senate. And if any of you were there for any of the testimonies and heard the actual testimony of victims, survivors, family members who have lost loved ones. It was an incredibly emotional event, and I think that it really opened the eyes to the public just what has been going on. So that's a little bit of background and context for this task force. We're going to jump into what is the MMIW injustices, and what we found in our report is that even though American Indian women and girls make up only 1% of our state's population, between the years of 2010 and 2018, 8% of all murdered women and girls in Minnesota were American Indian. And then given anywhere between the years of 2012 to 2020, from 27 to 54 American Indian women and girls in Minnesota were missing in any given month in that 8-year period. And this is just one of those tragedies that have happened kind of under the cloak of secrecy and misunderstanding around the world. And we're happy to bring this to you. Next slide, please. So first of all, we wanted to share with you the tribal nations that are here in Minnesota. We have 11 tribal nations, and on this map, you'll see the different locations, but it's really important to remember that not all of our Native folks live on reservations. In fact, less than 50%, I believe, live on reservations, and there is a lot of movement between the cities and the reservations. We have a very vibrant community here in Minneapolis and St. Paul and some of the other larger cities. But it's important to recognize that that one of the issues with that we knew and we were able to confirm in the task force is the jurisdictional complication of law when it comes to our Indian tribes. And on the last page, there was a reference to Public Law 280, which is the tribes on the left are under Public Law 280, and the tribes on the right are not. And you might wonder, what is Public Law 280? And basically, it is a federal jurisdiction that gave the states the ability to police on Indian reservations. And oftentimes it's within coordination with county. So we might have Indian reservation law, county, state, all of those sort of things. So on this page, you see that how complicated it can be. If you are a Native American and Indian victim, and the offender is American Indian, then the federal government or the tribes can then address your offense. But if you're non-Native, the federal government will cover your offense. And so it gets so very complicated. There's so many different variables in it, and that has been a huge issue within our addressing the missing and murdered Indigenous women within the tribes and the loss of it. Nobody knows, or it gets very confusing who they should go to, state or federal, and that's a big deal. So what we did is we examined systematic causes behind the violence in our Native American communities with Indigenous girls and women. We looked for appropriate methods for collecting data, and that has always been one of the biggest roadblocks. A lot of times folks have asked, well, how many is it? Where does it happen? Why is it happening? And we don't have the data, whether police agencies didn't track that data, or it might have been tracked different in different ways, recognizing different ethnicities incorrectly. And so the data collection is absolutely important. And then we are asking for reports on policies and institutions such as policing and child welfare. The foster care system has been historically almost like a super highway to sex trafficking and violence for our women and girls. The coroner's practices, we'd like to see those tighten up. And then there are other practices that impact violence against our Indigenous girls and women that is within the government. And those investigation and prosecution crimes of gender violence against our Indigenous people really do have to be addressed as well. So we also would like to receive reports on measures necessary to address and reduce the violence against the Indigenous women and girls, and then examine measures to help victims' families and communities that will help them, first of all, to prevent this violence and then heal from this violence. And I think when we look at the governor's budget, we'll see that there are some dollars that have been put aside specifically for some of these issues. Next slide, please. And so just an idea of who participated on this task force. I myself and Nicole Matthews were co-chairs through it. And then you'll see that we had representatives from both the House and the Senate, from the sheriff, from the U.S. attorney, epidemiologists, members from all of the tribes. There was at least one member from the tribe that participated. But it was also really important to have the voice of victims and survivors and their families, as well as the different resource agencies that are there for to help with our Indigenous communities when it comes to violence, such as Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, Nicole Matthews, Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, Mending the Sacred Hoop. Those were all different organizations that were decided upon by an initial group that I brought together of Native folks, and they are the ones that really helped put this bill together. They were the ones that said, we need to have representation from these different agencies and associations and these resources to make this a really, really robust and valid task force. And so with that, I am now going to hand it over to Nicole Martin Rogers, and she's going to explain what we actually did or what the task force did. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Kunish, and welcome again, Ms. Rogers. I hope I have the name right. Martin Rogers.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I'm pleased to be here to talk about the task force's work. So the Minnesota Department of Public Safety was the lead agency in charge of managing the task force, and Nigel Perrote, who is formerly of DPS, now of the Minnesota Sexual Assault Coalition, and Kate Weeks from DPS were instrumental in kind of coordinating the task force and carrying out all this work. I work for Wilder Research, and we were contracted by the Department of Public Safety to conduct the research and to produce this report that we're summarizing for you here today. And Stephanie Autumn is an independent contractor who was also contracted to help facilitate the focus group or the task force, excuse me. I'd like to extend my thanks to her as well. And so the task force did a number of different things. We started off having all day in-person meetings. We had three meetings before the COVID pandemic started, and then we moved to holding the task force meetings virtually. All of these meetings included expert presenters, such as we had a coroner present, we had the judge present who presided over the Canadian MMIW task force. We had someone from the clearinghouse, missing persons clearinghouse at the BCA present. We also held a number of community forums where community members, including survivors and victims and their relatives, were able to speak about their experiences to the task force members. We conducted an extensive literature review of research and articles about the MMIW injustice from across Turtle Island, that's North America. And we also conducted interviews with 32 experts who work on various aspects of this issue. And all those things, plus the data that we reviewed from the state, kind of formed the basis of the report. So we obtained data from the state about child welfare and human trafficking, homicides, missing persons data, related crimes, and all this data is reflected in the report. And then the task force deliberated as a large group and within subcommittees to kind of brainstorm and refine the mandates or recommendations that are included in the report. So I'm just going to briefly go over some of the key findings from the report, and then I'll turn it over to Nicole Matthews to wrap things up. So we first looked at the root causes of the MMIW injustice, and this is a very complex problem that started basically when Europeans landed on the shores of North America, and it's a problem that took over 500 years to create. So to think about the task force as sort of starting to unwrap these complex layers of this problem, and this is really the first layer, is these root causes, including colonization and historic trauma that Indigenous communities have experienced, ongoing racism and historic racism, and also the sexual objectification of Indigenous women and girls. So again, this is just kind of the top layer of the onion. These factors can explain why some Indigenous women and girls are more likely than other demographic groups to go missing or become victims of violence or exploitation. There's also systemic factors that increase the risk of becoming missing or murdered for Indigenous women and girls. These include poverty, lack of housing, involvement in the child welfare system and the criminal justice system, being a victim of domestic violence, being involved in prostitution and trafficking. So it's important to really think about this issue systemically, meaning to understand how all these factors add up in an individual's life to make them more vulnerable to becoming a victim or to being exploited. These are factors that can be traced back to the root causes we saw a minute ago. These are not an individual's poor choices or bad lifestyle that have created this MMIW injustice that we have in our society. It's more systemic than that. And I'll show you a bit of data to illustrate it in these areas. So this chart shows a key fact that probably will not surprise many of you. American Indian children are very much overrepresented among children who are placed out of their homes by the child protection system in Minnesota. And this pattern of taking children from their families and communities can again be traced all the way back to boarding schools. And even earlier than that, it's a pattern that's been established across generations, and it's caused trauma to families and communities. And that has also led in a lot of cases to breakdown of effective family systems, loss of traditional parenting practices. It's also created tremendous mistrust of the system among American Indian families. But what this data doesn't show, and what Senator Kunesh alluded to a moment ago, is the link to the MMIW injustice. So the Minnesota Department of Human Services reported that 601 American Indian children ran away from their out-of-home care between 2015 and 2019. Many of those children may be exploited or trafficked, which puts them on a direct path to either becoming incarcerated or becoming a missing and murdered Indigenous person. And so this is one point in the system that creates disparities that leads to this increased risk for Indigenous people over time of becoming MMIW. Similarly, we can see that Indigenous women are more likely to experience domestic violence than women of other races. Over half of Native women have experienced some kind of physical abuse from an intimate partner during their lifetime. American Indian women are also overrepresented among intimate partner homicide victims. One challenge that I learned about through the MMIW task force work that I did was the extent to which county law enforcement may or may not have access to information about orders for protection that are issued by tribal courts. And even if they have that information, to what extent they honor these orders for protection. So, you know, really, what are we doing and what are these overlapping jurisdictional agencies doing to protect women once we know they're at risk of becoming an MMIW? They've already been documented to have issues of intimate partner violence. So there are jurisdictional issues really that we can't get into in terms of the details of like these orders for protection and stuff. But we also want to make sure that you know that jurisdictional issues are only part of it. So there's actual legal barriers to effectively enforcing domestic violence and other issues related to MMIW in Indian country. And it's also that there are barriers created by the way that law enforcement is practiced at the county, municipal, and tribal government level. So the extent to which perpetrators of these crimes are held accountable is another part of it. We heard testimony from victims' families who are convinced that this victim was killed by her intimate partner, but the case was ruled as a suicide and closed. One of the recommendations from the task force is to do a case review of all these different cases. And it seems to me from what I heard anecdotally that there's more than just a few of them where the cause of death was determined to be a suicide or a drug overdose, but the families believe that there was foul play involved. So these numbers actually may be an underestimate of the actual extent to which American Indian women are victims of domestic violence and intimate partner homicide, and again, how this contributes to the overall MMIW injustice. So another risk factor, being homeless or not having stable housing, it's a huge risk factor for Indigenous women and girls to become exploited or be victimized. And we know that American Indians are very much overrepresented, again, among those who are experiencing homelessness in our state. Many of these women end up staying in abusive relationships or doing other things like getting involved with prostitution, trading sex for drugs or for a place to stay, just because they really don't have any other options. And finally, we can see that Indigenous people are very overrepresented among sex trafficking victims in Minnesota. The stereotypical image that many of us have in our heads of a woman who is being held in chains in the back of a cargo van, it's not really the reality of how trafficking happens in many or most cases. you know, a woman finds herself in a desperate situation due to poverty, and the exploiters may offer her emotional or material security. She may have shame about her situation, might have deep-seated feelings that she deserves to be treated poorly because of a lifetime of abuse. Maybe she has normalized violence if she grew up in a situation where violence was commonplace. All of these things are risk factors that predators use to their advantage to keep women and girls entrapped without actually having to use chains to do that. Indigenous women and girls are overrepresented in each of these areas. So this is another layer of the onion, another way in which the risk keeps increasing at each stage for Indigenous women and girls to become MMIW. Now I'm going to turn it over to Nicole Matthews, who's going to talk about the ways in which Indigenous women and girls do not receive fair treatment once they become missing or the victims of violence.
Thank you. And I also want just to check in, Chair Mariani, are we saving questions till after? I see there are several questions.
Yes, and this is Ms. Matthews. Yes, indeed. And I haven't given a time. I really want to make sure we have a good conversation, but hoping we can at least get 10 minutes of questions in. Please proceed, and then we'll do questions. There are four individuals who are lined up for questions already.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. So some of the findings, you know, when an Indigenous woman or girl does go missing or dies under suspicious circumstances, we know, and what we've heard is that the investigation, the prosecution, and the sentencing that are supposed to serve justice often fail to provide equal and fair treatment for Indigenous victims. And we heard several instances of that from service providers and from families alike. Also going back to sex trafficking, 401 victims and 173 sex trafficking incidents. So I think we really need to look at the connection. And I know our organization a number of years ago, about 10 years ago now, actually released a report where we interviewed 105 Native women in Minnesota on their experience being used in trafficking. And we know there's a huge connection between trafficking and missing and murdered Indigenous women, and also, you know, connected to homelessness and all of the issues that have already been brought up. But these are some of the statistics about it. You know, only 182 arrests made, 96 charges, and only 32 convictions. And so you can see the number of victims and then translating to only a small percentage of that where there was convictions. I think prevention and healing is a really big piece. You know, we know that culturally appropriate and culturally responsive healing resources are the most impactful. And, you know, when we did this this work, and also when I interviewed women for our trafficking report, we heard over and over again, Indigenous women want other Indigenous service providers to really, you know, that are providing the services to really understand their needs. And I think that's really critical. Can go forward. So this is what we set out to do, is to, you know, develop what we are calling mandates. We wanted to make sure that it was something a little stronger than recommendations, because we think these are things that are really critical and must happen in to ensure safety for our Indigenous relatives in the state of Minnesota. At the top of that list, of course, is to create a missing and murdered Indigenous women's office. And that would be an office to work with several key stakeholders across the state who will take a real deeper dive into this issue, that will ensure that we are getting movement on this issue, that systems are responding appropriately. They would provide, be responsible for providing an annual MMIW report and dashboard to give an ongoing overview of what is happening with this issue, and to keep it on the forefront. All right. And I will not cover, just in the interest of time and wanting to save time for questions, I will not cover every single one, but I will cover a few of them that I think are most critical. I shouldn't say most critical, but I think what we need to do is increase the personnel and state resources dedicated to addressing the MMIW injustice, which also connects with the addressing the harm that the child welfare system has done to Indigenous families and communities. We know that there are huge numbers of out-of-home placement of our Native children, and many people have talked about it as an extension of the boarding school era. You know, we don't have forced removal of our children to boarding schools, but we have very high numbers of out-of-home placement. And we see many children who are running from out-of-home placements and ending up being exploited on the streets or going missing and never being seen or heard from again. And so we know that, you know, 23% of American Indian children run away from those homes. Thank you. We need to provide age-appropriate, culturally responsive, and trauma-informed education on healthy relationships and consent to all students. You know, one thing we know, and we, you know, the connection between trafficking and prostitution, and the average age of entry to prostitution is 12 or 13, and yet we lack the critical information within our school system to really talk about healthy relationships and consent. And also, you know, we can't only talk to women. Prevention is about also educating and changing the social norms around healthy relationships, about healthy masculinity. And it's critical to be having those conversations in our with our students in a healthy way, because we know they're having those conversations amongst their peers through social media, and they're getting that information elsewhere. So I think it's critical that we have some hand in how that information is being given to them and what information. And then related to sex trafficking, requiring that sex trafficking awareness training and targeted prevention in Indian country, the connection to extractive industries such as oil and mining camps, to casinos and hotels, which are oftentimes the only large businesses or meeting facilities in tribal communities. And so it's not surprising that it is a place where trafficking is happening, where people are being targeted, where they're going missing, because it's a hub in those communities where people gather. And Thank you,
Nicole. So that is just a bit of what the report was able to put together. I would encourage all of you to look at that report, review it. It's very well written. It's easy to read and understand and extract the findings. Fortunately, we were able to get a 6-month extension to wrap up some of these final issues. Because of COVID, we weren't able to do as much as we would have wanted to. And so, again, I would encourage you all to read the report. We have that continuation through June of 2021, and we'll be working on developing the implementation plan. And as I said, within the governor's budget there, he did budget some funds for 2 years to open up that MMIW office, as well as provide some of the educational program around prevention and sex trafficking. And so I'm very, very encouraged and very happy that we'll be able to continue the work. And this isn't going to be a report that just is shared and then put off on a shelf somewhere, because this is something that we'll need to continue working on for quite some time. I want to remind folks that on February 14th, as we have for the last 5 years, there is a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Rally. Usually it starts at the Indian Community Center on Franklin Avenue, but due to COVID, there will be a virtual one. I think it's like a 3-day event, and Nicole Matthews is putting that one together. You can visit Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition and find information on that. And then, of course, forming this office to continue the conversation and ensure that we are addressing the needs of all of our indigenous communities. And, you know, it's almost safe to say that when we make improvements or create better databases or are sharing more information or create a working relationship jurisdictionally, it's not just going to benefit our Native communities, but it's going to benefit the entire state. And that's really what we aim to do is make sure that there isn't a next one. There isn't yet another girl, boy, two-spirit that goes missing or misidentified as murdered when indeed they are identified as suicide or something like that when indeed they had been murdered. And so with that, we just want to say Chi Migwich, Hopala Tonka, and thank you. And you'll see on the last page there's contact information for Nicole Martin Rogers. She holds the information. We could not have done this report without Nicole, without Nigel Perot, without Kate Weeks, without Stephanie Autumn. And so from the bottom of my heart, I absolutely want to thank all the legislators that supported this as well as those that worked on the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh and Ms. Matthews and Ms. Martin Rogers. Members, we have about 20 minutes, maybe 17 minutes till we get to 2 o'clock, at which point I want the committee to focus on the second part that is Representative Vice. Bill, we do have 5 questions. I think we can get through them. Let me actually 6 questions because I'll be the first. Senator Kunesh or the others, incredibly important work for our state. I know that we're not alone as a state to come at this issue clearly and directly in terms of focusing on something that arguably has not receive the attention that it deserves. Mm-hmm. I do know, however, that well over a decade ago, then U.S. Attorney Tom Heffelfinger, who was a Bush era, a Bush administration appointee, had opened up a number of conversations around this issue of the complicated jurisdictional issues here. In my mind, it was the first time I had heard this issue. We don't have time to get into the deep complexities of this, no doubt. And I suspect that perhaps in the Judiciary Committee, if there's a hearing there, there might be some opportunities for that as well. But I'm wondering if you can just say something very quickly about whether those jurisdictional issues, I think you've already said it, but maybe just to emphasize the importance of addressing those issues in addition to the program issues, the training issues, the awareness issues that no doubt are going to be coming forward. And perhaps provocatively, if the U.S. Attorney tried to work on that, how come it hasn't been fixed? Is it because the state didn't pay attention to it? Or just some very quick thoughts from you.
Well, my initial thoughts are that because there are so many of these layers and confusion around who is absolutely responsible for investigating any of these things, any of these crimes, whether it's the federal government or the local government or the state government or police forces. So nobody does it. And oftentimes when it is a federal offense, it takes a while for somebody to get to the investigator, to get to the scene, to begin the investigation and that sort of thing. And so because of the confusion, because of the sort of a lack of just a sense of real disregard, or it's not that important, we're not going to deal with it. Nobody has really addressed it to this point. And so this task force hopefully has opened up those avenues of conversation and collaboration, both within the reservation police and the county and the state.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I get that sometimes we want to answer everything through legislation, and legislation is absolutely important.
Yeah.
In this case, to provide some direction and support, particularly for our local law enforcement in terms of helping them to focus. But I also get that sometimes it isn't about legislation. It's about creating those collaborative spaces where people can
absolutely
work, community with government, with local law enforcement, et cetera. Very well. Let's see if we can get through these. I have Representative Bodney, Lucero, Pinto, Frazier, and Hollins. And let's see if we can do this in 15 minutes. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question is for Presenter Martin Rogers. You made a point in your presentation talking about protection orders from tribal units not being enforced. And I find that pretty concerning. Is there something in those protection orders that we need to fix, or something that we can do on a state level to fix those? We enforce court orders from Canada, and it should be fairly universal and standard. So I would be concerned if there's a specific agency that is not enforcing a tribal order, could you forward me that information? And then, like I said, is there something that needs to be fixed, or something we can do on our end to make sure that, a victim of domestic violence, no matter where they live, gets the same protection?
Great question. Ms. Hart Rogers?
Thank you, Representative. I will look back and see what data I have that I can provide to you on that. My understanding is that it's not a legal or legislative issue, but it's a practice issue of just when a tribal court has issued an order for protection, that it might not be handled the same way by county or municipal law enforcement as when an order for protection is issued by a state court.
Well, and Ms. Martin Rogers, very quickly to Representative Devati's question, because he was asking also, if there's something going on there, let me know. Is there data being collected on that quality, if you will, of responses? And if not, is that something we should be doing?
I'm not aware of data that is systematically being collected on that issue. This is more of an anecdotal observation at this point, my understanding. I can follow up and confirm the answer to that question, though, but it does seem like it would be something. We had a difficult time in general, I think, getting the type of data that we wanted out of the court system because of how they are able to or not track perpetrators and victims and their race and ethnicity. We're interested in particular about cases that are affecting Indigenous women and girls, and that a lot of the data wasn't available to the courts about this or any of the other issues that we had looked at. Like, for example, another one was sentencing related to domestic violence convictions, right? And how severe the sentence might be if the victim is Indigenous versus a victim who's not Indigenous, and those data aren't available. So now it's just anecdotal observations from people.
Yeah, and I would think this is, merits some follow-up conversation with some of our law enforcement associations or sheriffs, for instance. I'm wondering very quickly, I should have been paying closer attention. There were law enforcement presence on the task force, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Senator Kunish?
Absolutely. There were sheriff and reservation and just about every different level of force in the state.
Okay. We may want to hear from them when those bills come forward as well. Then, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you for the continued conversation on this very important issue. I know we've been having this conversation in the legislature for a number of years, and I am proud to have been among those that are supporting this. This is a nonpartisan or bipartisan concern, for sure. So thank you for those, and thank you for the efforts of everybody that are part of this. We have to bring a light, and that's what we're doing, and then solutions to help the unfortunate victims. One of I tried to take a quick screenshot here, and I've got it up in front of me. One of the statistics in the slides was 56% have experienced physical abuse from an intimate partner, and this was in relationship to Native American women. What that just stood out to me, very shocked. 56%. What is there any background? Why that's very alarming.
Yeah.
Why that might be? Why it's so high?
That was awfully high. I agree. Anyone wish to provide a response to that?
Well, I think we can look at the impact of of colonization and historical trauma and multi-generational, right? Like trauma and violence that has been happening for many years, for hundreds of years. I also think, we can go back to looking at some of the jurisdictional challenges, because oftentimes we know that the violence that's perpetrated against Native women is by non-Native perpetrators. And when we have jurisdictional loopholes that where the tribes don't have jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders, then it's problematic, right? Because they can't hold the offenders accountable, even within their own jurisdictions. Now, under the Tribal Law and Order Act and then under VAWA, tribes can prosecute non-Indian offenders of domestic violence, but there's only a handful of tribes across the nation that have completed the requirements to be able to implement those, because essentially they need to be set up, the courts need to be set up in a particular way. So I think it's a complicated answer. I agree, it's very alarming and it's very troubling that the rates of victimization are that high against our relatives.
Well, and obviously our state has worked awfully hard. I think we need to work harder at, moving upstream more, in addition to providing, the immediate responses that many of our law enforcement entities provide. We also need to go upstream and work heavily on, on the preventative side. We'll be having more conversations later this week about the challenges of that to our state, particularly in greater Minnesota. Very well. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's actually a really nice transition to my question and comment. So folks, some of the members of the committee may be aware, and hopefully the presenters too, my work as a prosecutor outside the legislature has involved a lot relating to human trafficking. And for a number of years, I was leading statewide training and protocol development. And I just, in our safe harbor system, addressing the exploitation and trafficking of young people especially. And so a big thank you to Senator Kunesh and to the presenters for your just incredible work. I wanna make sure to emphasize to members of the committee, members of the public, what was said about we might think of sex trafficking in terms of a particular image of someone being, your hands being bound in a particular kind of thing. And I just, that connection to poverty, if you want to address human trafficking, then you could do no better, to my mind, than be addressing issues of poverty, issues of homelessness, and then issues of gender and racial inequities. Yeah. And so no surprise then that when I train police officers, we talk about how it's the kids of color, young people of color who are disproportionately targeted, and then our indigenous young people who are way disproportionately targeted. Looking at any disparities in our state, those disparities are especially concentrated in the indigenous community. And if you're thinking about young women and girls who are indigenous, then you've got gender inequities and massive racial inequities. I'm so grateful to you for the work. I'm going to ask a question that I hope does not cause any trouble here. I just want to ask Senator Kunesh. I had heard the comment, she made a comment about a superhighway to trafficking, and I sort of missed the reference. And I just want to make sure, see what you were talking about, and just ask a quick question about that, or maybe make a comment as to what you're referring to.
Oh, I was referring to, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was referring to the foster care system and the disproportional removal of children into foster care. And then, of course, when those foster care kids are sort of let free at the age of 18 with no resources, and they're on the street and are so vulnerable to predators that are out there looking for them, it certainly is one of those direct routes into sex trafficking, prostitution, violence, and abuse.
Chair Pinto.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator. That was really helpful. I misheard you, and yeah, that's. I'm recalling a young woman who presented in Congress who'd been in the foster care system. We talked about how her experience moving from home to home, in a way, ended up really making her very accustomed. What she said is that her strongest connection was with her trafficker, in fact, in her life. And so, yeah, there's such a huge connection there. So again, thank you to you. It's so good to see you. And then to the other presenters, thanks so much for your work. And to members of the committee, if we really want to address this, let's think about our work and all the other committees we're on, as the chair said, in terms of going upstream on this, in addition to all the other incredible points made. So thank you.
Good advice, Chair Pinto. The intersectionality of these issues is very powerful. And by the way, I think the governor's budget is out now. Mm-hmm. Not sure if it is or not. I've been focused on this hearing. So I don't want to reveal stuff, but from the little bit, because I haven't seen it actually, but conversations, there is an interest in the administration to be able to beef up our work with our investments in preventing, interrupting, stopping sex trafficking across the state. I believe we severely underinvest in that. We do some pretty strong investments in some other areas that still also need work, like our drug interdiction work, valid work. We also severely underfund intervention and prevention in this area. I know that that's been an important issue for you, Chair Pinto. I look forward to having that conversation with you. Move forward. We have a few minutes left for questions. I'm going to jump over to Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Chair Mariani, and thank you so much to all of the presenters today. This was really wonderful and very informative. My question really centers around LGBTQ and Two-Spirit individuals, and I would like to know if there's any data that has tracked the outcomes for those folks. We know that just in the general population, individuals in the LGBTQ community are more likely to be homeless, to experience sex trafficking, et cetera. And so I'd love to know if you have any data around that as far as the intersectionality of Indigenous
folks. Whoever wishes to respond to that.
So I don't, and maybe Rogers can add as well. I am not aware of any data on that, although we know anecdotally, just like what you were saying, like we hear the not only are our Two-Spirit relatives more disproportionately used in trafficking, with homelessness and poverty and violence, right? And they're how old they will be when they pass is, you know, much lower. So, you know, we know what the risk factors are. We just don't have the data, much like the larger issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We don't have the data, which is why we did this. And so, Nicole Martin Rogers, I don't know if you have other pieces to add on that.
Ms. Martin Rogers.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Nicole. I would have given pretty much the same answer, is that anecdotally, we know that it's an issue, and we didn't mention it today, but in a lot of the references in the report, we did try to make sure, and the legislation includes women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, and we tried to include that to some degree when we are asking questions and looking at the data, but in terms of databases and stuff, most of them still use just male and female gender and other things like that that make it really difficult to get a true sense of that problem. But anecdotally, it's definitely something that we heard about and needs more research to do a better job to know the extent of the problem.
And if I may,
We
didn't focus on that for this report, though it is something that we would like to extend through the office. But I know the CDC at the national level has statistics that show that both lesbian and bisexual women or gay men or bisexual men experience that violence at higher rates than straight men or women. And that, and I'm just pulled this up right now, but 22% of bisexual women have been raped by intimate partners compared to 9% of straight women. So there are facts out there. There is data out there nationally, but again, Minnesota has not taken the time or invested in that data collection or the discussion around those groups of violence as well. And just as we said, this report is focusing on Native women and girls. We hope that it'll be a wake-up call and that there will be stronger interest and stronger reporting and investigation around all people, because we really do need to eradicate this kind of violence within our society, within our communities.
Indeed, Senator Kunesh, they are all our beloveds and they're all our residents and yep. neighbors and family members in our state.
Yep.
I do hear a strong message that it's really difficult to have effective public policy if the data isn't there. The data collection isn't updated, modernized to reflect, make sure that we're capturing reality out there.
Yep. And I will also just add to that and say that our organization is, we are starting to do research with our Two-Spirit relatives that have been impacted or used in prostitution and trafficking, much like we did with our Garden of Truth study. We are just starting to do that in our Two-Spirit community here in Minnesota. So within the next year or two, we will have that data compiled as well.
Very well, thank you. Representative Novotny, I still see your hand up. I don't know if that's from prior or did you want to do a follow-up? I just want to make sure I'm not dismissing you.
No, sir, I just didn't take it down.
Oh, okay, very well. Well, then our last question will be Vice Chair Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. We can move forward. In interest of time, we can move forward. I can ask my question offline.
You got a couple of minutes. Go for it.
Well, I was going to ask, appreciated the presentation. It was very thoughtful and informative. Is there anything in the recommendations that are provided in this report? Is there anything that wasn't providing those recommendations that the legislator can do to help with this issue?
Senator Kunesh or anyone else?
Well, we didn't ask for funding, but that will be some legislation coming down the road. We will be looking at different forms of data collection and possibly some mandates that come out of that. But maybe Nicole Martin Rogers, you would have a good answer to that as well.
Ms. Martin Rogers.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Thank you for your question. I think that some things that we can all do as individuals is make sure in our local area that our local systems are aware of this issue, right? So are hospitals aware of it? How is the local law enforcement handling it? What is their awareness of it? This school system? The county child protection system, all of these systems and the staff that the people that work within them really need to know what this looks like and to understand the ways in which we can support or fail an Indigenous child when they could be on this track to get into becoming at very high risk for MMIW. So I think those are the main things. And then of course there's federal legislation like VAWA that you can support. And so, yeah, those would be the main additional things that I would think as a legislator that you could do.
Thank you. Very well. Well, again, Senator Kunesh, Ms. Martin Rogers of the Wilder Research, Ms. Matthews of the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, deep gratitude for your work, for your passion, for your thoughtfulness and bringing us in the legislature important work that we must do for the people in my opinion, has been too long neglected and as a result, too much harm happening. I think the spirit is strong in the state to work effectively to address these issues, but we certainly needed the focus to be able to do that. I hope that we'll be able to do that going forward. One of the things that I've learned about Minnesota a long time ago is what an incredibly big state this is, what a geographically diverse state it is, and of course the special nature of our Indian nations, the many that exist within our state. That's not common in most states across the union. And what that means for me is that there are issues, in this case, of protecting and responding to victims of violence, and hopefully preventing them to become victims of violence, that transcend both across, you know, South Minneapolis, you know, to the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation. You know, it's a statewide commitment and value on our part as Minnesotans to make sure that wherever, you know, that wrong exists, that we've got powerful ways to respond to that across the entire state. So thank you for your work. Looking forward to the legislation coming forward. Members, with that, we're going to move to House File 321, Representative Feist. And, you know, members, this is the first time I've done this, I think, where I've had someone else moving a bill in virtual space here. So bear with me a little bit. Representative Feist, your motion before us, and I hope I have the right motion too, because I've gotten a little rusty on moving our bill. So I'll certainly turn to Mr. Lundy or Mr. Hultquist to help with this. But our Representative Feist, I believe your motion is that House File 321 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Representative Feist, is that your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move to refer House File 321 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Very well. The House File 321 is before us. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. This is my first time presenting a bill, so we have firsts.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk just briefly about the purpose of the U visa certification, the process involved, and then what this bill is trying to accomplish and what this bill is not trying to do. This bill has been heard by this committee previously. It was authored by Representative Gomez, and I am honored to be authoring it this year. So the U visa was created through the passage of the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act of 2000. As a key tool for law enforcement in the detection, investigation, and prosecution of certain serious criminal offenses. A significant percentage of U visas go to victims of domestic violence. Approximately 50% or less victims of domestic violence will report they will ever seek help. And amongst immigrant communities, even less seek assistance for a variety of reasons, including fear of removal. This bill, which pertains to the U visa certification process in Minnesota, is supported by MnCASA, Violence Free Minnesota, the Advocates for Human Rights, Standpoint, and we also have included with the materials a letter from Tony Patesnick, who is the Director of Public Safety for the City of New Brighton, describing the U visa process. And in his statement, he wrote, "We have found the process of certifying the form I-918 administratively uncomplicated and worthwhile in protecting victims of serious crimes in New Brighton and ensuring that perpetrators are brought to justice." In terms of terminology, I just want to point out that this process moves through the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. ICE has no role in this process. So as an immigration lawyer, we'll just keep our terminology precise. So in terms of who is eligible for a U visa, it is for victims of enumerated serious crimes who have demonstrated that they have been or will be helpful to law enforcement in the detection, investigation, and prosecution of a crime. In terms of the process, the victim will fill in the form I-918 completely, and then they send it to the law enforcement agency. The law enforcement agency reviews the form, all of the relevant supporting documents, which have been provided by the victim already, including a description of their helpfulness to law enforcement. And then the law enforcement agency simply signs if they agree that this victim was indeed helpful in their investigation or prosecution of a crime. So as Director Patesnick said in his statement, this process is administratively easy. The issue that arises is often that the agencies are not familiar with the U visa process and can be confused about what is their role, how does this work, how fast are they supposed to respond, and that is what this bill seeks to address. I had a great conversation with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and they do not oppose this bill and agree that there's often just confusion on the ground when people receive this form. As an immigration lawyer, I can tell you all immigration forms are terrible, so I don't blame them for being confused. Once the U visa form is certified by law enforcement, the victim can then apply to the Immigration Service, or USCIS, for a U visa. The certification does not guarantee approval. The process takes many, many years, and it does not necessarily protect them from removal. In terms of what we are trying to do with this bill, as I said, we're trying to create consistency in terms of the administrative process and timelines around the U visa process. We have laid out exactly what the U visa is supposed to do, how it's supposed to work, and some specific timelines in the bill. And so that will be hopefully helpful to law enforcement, as well as to protecting the victims that seek their help and protection. Minnesota is a leader in protecting victims of domestic violence, and this bill really seeks to protect those victims. In terms of what this bill does not do, it is not an immigration bill. We are not creating new eligibility under the U visa process. We are not requiring law enforcement to certify the form. They can respond and say no. So it's not creating any new rights or obligations on the part of law enforcement. It also does not create automatic protection from removal. And that was a question that was previously asked in this committee. And so I thought I'd address it up front. So now I am very excited by the number of advocates and experts we have on hand to present and answer questions. Our two presenters will be Erica Staub. She is the executive director of the Hope Center in Faribault, Minnesota, and works regularly with victims of domestic violence. In addition, we have Vina Ayer. She is the executive director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, and they also work very regularly with U visas and victims of domestic violence. In addition, we have experts and advocates on hand to answer questions from MnCASA, Violence Free Minnesota, as well as Standpoint, and we have a private immigration attorney who is also an expert in this process. So I am going to turn it over at this point, or maybe Chair Mariani does this, but someone will turn it over to Ms. Staub from the Hope Center to share her comments.
Representative Feist, they are your witnesses, and so you can certainly call on them. Obviously, everything always goes through the chair. I do want to acknowledge that on the page, rather the committee website, we've got a list of written testimony from a number of advocates for the bill. I suspect a number from the organizations you listed, as well as individuals who have been directly impacted by the issue that you're hoping to address. But with that, Representative Feist, it sounds like you want the chair to call up Ms. Erica Staub first from the Hope Coalition in Faribault, Minnesota. Ms. Staub, and I hope I pronounced your last name right, but feel free to correct me.
You did. No, I appreciate that. Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and the other members of the committee. I'm so thankful to be here. My name is Erica Staub, and I'm the director of Hope Center, and we are a domestic violence sexual assault agency located here in Rice County. I've been working to end violence for the past 25 years and have spent the past 14 working with Hope Center. We know that abuse rates amongst immigrant women are as high as 49.8%, according to a recent national study. That is almost three times the national average. So we know, particularly for our clients who are coming here to America, that is something that they've experienced both in their home communities and also experience here. But first, before I talk about the clients, I want you to think about your past year. How has your world turned upside down? How has it felt having someone else call the shots in ways that you're not used to? How has it felt to be thinking, is this worth the risk to go to the store? Is this worth the risk to leave my home? Suddenly, you're forced to look at life through a very different lens. During the pandemic, we received the opportunity to live in limbo. And this is what our clients live like all the time. To not be quite sure when life would return to a semblance of normal, to live under the constant anxiety of danger at every turn, and to feel out of control of pretty much everything. The clients that we work with have to fill out forms, wait certain time periods, knowing that if they miss that important phone call or that piece of mail, they could be in danger of deportation, of further violence. I want to share one experience of a client that we had who's I'll call her Maria. She endured 23 years of abuse. She had come to the U.S. hopeful to end the violence. Her husband promised that things would change once I got to America. 48% of Latinas in a recent national study reported that their violence actually increased once they got to America. And things for Maria didn't change, they got worse. The domestic violence increased, the sexual assault increased, and she had fewer resources and wasn't sure where to turn. She didn't know who to call or who to reach out to. And she was promised by her abuser that if she sought any help, he would deport her. So for many years, she stayed silent. Until one particularly horrific experience of abuse where she reached her breaking point both physically and emotionally and was luckily put in touch with Hope Center. We were able to connect her with resources with in order for protection and connection with an attorney to help complete the visa process. He was arrested for the abuse, and even while he was in jail, he continued to violate his conditions, continued to reach out, write her letters, beg for her forgiveness, and promise things would change. From a systems perspective, there's hours of advocacy on our end, law enforcement, prosecution, jail time. All of these things would be impacted dramatically if we could reduce the amount of time that the abuser has the opportunity to continue to abuse. At this point, their son was having to support the family because he was legally able to work, but she was not. Oftentimes, our clients are told by their lawyers that during this period of time, it is best if you don't have employment, if you continue just to kind of do what you're legally supposed to do at this time. So she was finally able to have her U visa granted and was able to move on, get a job, and to continue to provide for her family and to begin the process of healing. The other thing I just want to raise up is the idea of not only the impact on our clients, but on their children. So often these children are placed in impossible situations. Should they ask their parent to drive them to school, knowing that if they're caught, they could get a ticket, or that it might mean deportation? They live in constant fear that immigration is coming and their parents will be torn. We know that for many of our clients, they've lived through this terror because the parent who has been arrested for abuse has been taken away. So as a child, the impact and the unknown of all of this lasts for a very long time. And so we know that it's important to help reduce the stress and trauma. And so this is one of the easy ways that we can do that. The shorter the time period until that victim that we're working with can access the resources that she needs to be able to get a head start in her own life and to be able to not be under the auspices of the abuser, the more likely it is that this child can then now go to school knowing that, okay, one less thing I can worry about and I can actually focus on my studies. We know that the clients that we assist with, their U visas take an average to 4 to 5 years. That is one third of the education of these children, that they're living terrified that their parents are going to be torn from them. Oftentimes our clients are terrified to reach out for help. We just got a call literally yesterday from a client who wants to work with us, but is terrified because she is afraid to miss a phone call from immigration, who will call randomly to check that she is where she says she was. And so she's afraid to leave the abusive situation because she doesn't want to jeopardize the process. And so she was terrified to work even with us because of that, because she didn't want to look bad. She wanted to make sure that she was doing all of the things that were necessary for her to get her U visa. And so many of our clients are trying to do the right thing, to follow the right rules. And again, if we can shorten that time period, it just shortens that trauma that happens. We as a community cannot change what happened, but we can certainly change our response and we can change the timelines. And so that is something that we can fall under, that falls under our auspices. So collectively as a community, and even you guys are talking about prevention and trauma reduction and all of these things, they are all intertwined. And we know that there are sometimes really easy things we can do. And I would offer that this is probably one of those times that this is a really easy thing to do. We know that all the literature points to the importance of swift and sure consequences being a deterrent for further abuse. By giving our victims an opportunity to have some power and control over their own lives, we can help them prevent further trauma. So I would love to hear any more, but that's what I have for you today. So thank you so much for this opportunity. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
I work in Faribault, Minnesota, a town that I have visited a lot in the past and that I really like.
I love it here, too.
Members, we're running short. We have 10 minutes left. We have motion before us. We do have another testifier. Ms. Fina Iyer, so I'm going to ask Ms. Iyer if you can just be really brief, and then we'll see if we can get a few of these. We have quite a few questions that are lined up. Just a forewarning, members, we're not going to get to everyone's questions before the vote. With that, Ms. Iyer.
Thank you so much, Chair Mariani, Vice Chair Frazier, and Minority Lead Johnson for having us here today, and of course to Representative Feist for both introducing this bill and asking me to speak today. My name is Vina Iyer, and I am the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, which represents low-income immigrants and refugees and also provides education and advocacy related to immigration. In 2019, we served clients coming from 115 countries. We represent many crime victims seeking protection through special programs created by Congress, including the U visa, which was created as a route to safety for immigrant victims of crime. As you have heard, U visa applications require certification from local police departments that the applicant is a crime victim and is cooperating in investigation or prosecution of the case. That certification is the first step in a lengthy process that at this time usually takes more than 5 years. Our clients in U visa cases are typically victims of domestic violence. These clients arrive at our initial interview suffering from post-traumatic stress after years of abuse or injured after an attempted strangulation or traumatized by stalking and terroristic threats. Others may be victims of sexual assault or less frequently, other crimes. They risk a lot by cooperating with police to make a case against those who victimize them. Often abuser threatens to call immigration and have you deported. The U visa offers protection to victims who help police bring criminals to justice and who protect our communities. It's understandable, the U visa process is confusing, and we can understand the confusion, as Representative Feist said, of police and of other law enforcement officials. That's what makes this legislation even more important. By defining a standard response to a request for certification, the bill gives direction to police and prosecutors on their critical role in this process. Just to provide a little bit more information, the basic application form for U visa is a I-918 form. The law enforcement certification is called the I-918 Supplement B. In that supplement, law enforcement confirms that this person is a victim of a qualifying crime, describes the crime, says whether the certifying officer knows of harm suffered by the victim, and certifies that the victim has cooperated with law enforcement. This law enforcement certification must be completed first before a U visa application and a supporting package can be sent to immigration. And importantly, in the very best case scenario, after that packet of forms is filled, an attorney will get a receipt acknowledging filing in 8 to 10 weeks, but then the victim will wait years for approval. In a recent case, the application package was filed in September 2015. In May 2020, Immigration issued a notice of deferred action, which wasn't a status, provided temporary work authorization, but wasn't even the U visa. Finally, in January of this year, over 5 years after the application was filed, the crime victim received full protection under the U visa program, putting her on the road to eventual legal permanent residence. This lengthy wait is due to both a 10,000 annual cap on U visas and delays in processing all immigration applications. These are federal issues. There's nothing Minnesota law can do about this, but we can do something about the certification portion of this and make sure that that is done in a timely way. This can eliminate doubt and delay in issuing crucial law enforcement certification of the I-19 Supplement B. That's what this legislation is about. For the sake of clarity for law enforcement and for the sake of protecting crime victims and keeping our community safe, we ask you to pass this legislation. Thank you, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Ms. Iyer. Members, we have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to call on a couple of members, and then we're going to go to a vote. If there's still time, we'll continue to take questions after that. But Representative Mueller. And you might be muted, Representative Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Took a second just to undo everything. So I really appreciated all the testifiers and also to Representative Feist for bringing this bill forward. But I have a couple of concerns, but for the interest of time, I'm only going to bring up one. This bill specifically states that an active investigation, the filing of charges, or a prosecution of conviction are not required for the victim of criminal activity to request and obtain certification. We just heard testifiers talk about how a law enforcement must sign off before they're able to move forward in this process. My husband is a pastor in the place where I live down in 27B, and he works with the multi-ethnic communities in our community and is personally involved in several of these cases where people come to him for trusted advice. He has personally witnessed people who have told some of these applicants or of some people who are desperate to stay in the country or whatever, that if you apply for this visa that you are able to, or if you claim that you are a victim, that then you can get this visa. I am concerned about abuse. I wanna know, with this language in the bill, are there any ways for, especially if there is no investigation that is required, in fact, it says it does not have to even happen or filing of charges at all, how can we hold people accountable that the people who are applying for this visa really are the true victims that desperately need to have protections that they deserve? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Feist?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Mueller. That's a really good question. So the U visa is only for victims of certain very serious enumerated crimes, such as sexual assault, murder, kidnapping. So, you know, anybody can say, like, make up some sort of random, you know, victimhood, but the type of victims that the U visa was intended to create a pathway for through this process were only victims of very serious crimes. In addition, this bill would not require law enforcement to certify a U visa if they don't believe that that victim was actually helpful in their investigating a crime. And it may be that they investigate a crime with the help of a U visa or with the help of a victim, and that investigation does not lead to a conviction or a prosecution for whatever reason. But that doesn't change the fact that under the federal U visa law, that the victim was indeed helpful as a witness to law enforcement. In addition, after the U visa a certification process, the applicant still needs to send a huge application, much bigger than just the certification process, to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And that comes with all sorts of supporting documentation, extensive statements, and they really need to convince the Immigration Service that they can prove that they were indeed a victim of a crime. And I didn't go into all of the details of the U visa requirements, but you do need to show like a certain level of harm and emotional impact of the U visa. In fact, I can just read. You need to show, oh shoot, I deleted that. But anyway, you need to show that you really have suffered as a result of being a victim of a very serious crime. I'm sorry I answered that instead of throwing it to all of my experts in the interest of time. But does that, I can throw it to an expert, but we have 1 minute left. So.
Yes, you do. Let me get another question in for Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate it. This is an incredibly important and very far-reaching bill that I think is going to help a lot of people. And my question relates to specifically underneath United States Code Title 8, Section 1184, Subsection P. It states under Section 2, Subsection A, that the number of aliens who may be issued visas or otherwise provided status as non-immigrants under this code in any fiscal year shall not exceed 10,000. And if we do just a single apportionment of the 50 states, does that mean we've only get 200 of these in Minnesota? And if that's the case, how many do we actually have in Minnesota that we're trying to protect?
Representative Feist?
Yep. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Good question. So because of the 10,000 cap on U visas, there is a massive backlog. One recent report that I read said it can last as long as 15 years. And as Ms. Ayer described, she has a case recently that took 5 years. It's not apportioned between the states. So it's just 10,000 per year, first in, first out. And it's a huge problem. That doesn't directly impact this bill, which is just the certification process. But I do believe that we should do something about that at the federal level because it is a problem and it limits the impact of this the U visa at all.
Very well. Members, we're up against, thank you for those questions, by the way. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Members, we're up against the clock. This bill needs to move to another committee where it'll be vetted. There's a good chance it'll be back here. That was certainly the case 2 years ago. We'll see. A number of you are on the Judiciary Committee where you can follow up further. With
Chair Mariani, will this be roll called?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Representative Johnson. There will be a roll call. So members, Representative Feist renews her motion that, let me get the right number, House File 321, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. It's got a longer name than that, but our Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll on that motion.
Chair Mariani?
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, point of parliamentary inquiry, please.
Yes, of course.
And again, I apologize if this is out of order and I'm pretty new. I really want to hear the testimony in this committee on what's going on, specifically making sure that all the questions that each of us had. And I would like to ask if Section 331 of Mason's is in order to lay this motion on the table at this point so that we can have a continuation of this discussion and hear from the additional questions and the rest of the people that wanted to testify on this, Mr. Chair.
Representative Raleigh, fair enough. I would encourage us not to do that, but that motion would be in order. We were in the middle of a roll, unfortunately. And so I'd like to finish that roll, and depending on what happens, that might be another motion. The clerk will take the roll on the motion to refer House File 321 to the Committee on Finance or the Judiciary Committee on Finance and Policy.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt? Representative Hewitt? Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero? Representative Lucero? Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative O'Neill? Representative O'Neill? Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Rowley?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill? That completes roll call.
Very well. Clerk, I have 11 ayes and 6 nays.
That is correct.
Very well. With 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion passes and House File 321 is referred to Committee on Judiciary. Members, this bill will be heard in Judiciary. I hope that it can be further vetted through, and it could well be back here at some point as well for further vetting. I really would hope that we can move this bill forward in a strong bipartisan manner. And I will certainly work to make sure that we've got time to fully vet these bills. I think that we did vet this bill last couple of years. You know, part of what we constantly wrestle with here is to make sure that we're carefully hearing legislation at the same time that we're moving legislation, because that's our purpose here. So I will continue to work with every member here to make sure that we can certainly do that. Members, with that, we will meet again on Thursday at 1 o'clock at our standing time. And until such time, this committee stands adjourned.